I sort of have two hats that I wear. So I direct an institute at Johns Hopkins University called the SNF Agora Institute, which we have a mission to try to strengthen global democracy and try to think about how we harness the resources of the university to try to make an impact on strengthening democracy around the world. And then I also run a research lab called the P3 Lab. And we call it P3 because we're interested in trying to understand how we make the participation of ordinary people possible, probable, and powerful. So people have to want to participate, they have to be able to participate, and then it actually has to matter. And increasingly, it feels like more and more the work that we're doing focuses on that last question of powerful, which is meaning, how do you make the participation of ordinary people actually matter? Like so often, it feels like all over the world, we can see people pour into the streets as we're seeing today in lots of places around the world, and government seems not to respond. And so it feels like we're in this moment right now where we have to really understand how we build the kind of vehicles that we need to translate the participation and the engagement of people, of our members and our base into the actual kind of political power that we need to make the change that we want. So that's what this book and this project is really about. But before I get into that, just for those of you who I haven't had a chance to get to know yet, just to introduce myself a little bit. I grew up as a daughter of Korean immigrants in Texas. My parents immigrated from Korea. They were originally refugees from North Korea, then moved down to South Korea, and then eventually moved to the United States where I was born. And so much of my life growing up was the experience of watching my parents try to figure out what it meant to raise a family in the United States. And so if you can hopefully see the picture on your screen, like I'm the little girl in the orange sweater. You know, my parents took us to Mount Rushmore, which is a national park in the United States that has the heads of presidents carved into it, because it felt like that's what you had to do if you grew up in America. And my parents, when they originally came from Korea, even though they came from well-established families in Korea, they sort of showed up in the United States with the proverbial $100 in their pockets. And so my mom cleaned people's houses, my dad mowed people's lawns, and they tried to just figure out how to make it. And a lot of what I saw was watching them kind of climb that social ladder in a sense. And the reason why I tell that story is because I think it's really relevant to why I do the work that I do. Because it wasn't until I went to college that I really learned about social movements and organizing. And I think it really spoke to me immediately. And the reason why is because at the heart of what makes organizing or social movements work is this idea of transformation. And that was one of the lessons I think that I learned as a child of immigrants, not because anyone ever said the words to me, but because it was just there in the background of our lives that what we do as humans is try to transform ourselves so that we can transform our families and transform the world around us. And that's what I saw my parents trying to do. And that's what really spoke to me when I first began to learn about what organizing is. And so over the course of my career, a lot of the work that I've been trying to do is trying to understand, you know, how do we pull people off the sidelines of public life and engage them in the work of constructing the kind of world and the community that they want to live in? And I think that was probably some of the work that I talked with you all about last time that I was in Australia. But this last book, I think, really came out of the sense that we're in this moment right now where it feels like so many of the systems that we have, especially in the United States, but also in many of the many advanced democracies around the world, the systems themselves seem to be failing. It feels like they are not equipped to be able to address the kind of most pressing challenges that we face as a global community. And so this book kind of started with this question of how do we begin to equip people to transform a failing system, right? How do you people learn to act and act with power when the system itself seems like it's falling apart in some ways? And we landed on this analogy of a prism. If I was there in person, I'd hold up a prism and I'd try to shoot some light through it so you could see it. But you know what a prism does is it takes white light in, and then it transforms that white light into this vector of rainbows, right, that carries as far as the light can see. And I think it felt like those are the kind of movements that we need, right? We need movements that can take people in and transform their engagement into a vector of power that carries as far as the light can see. And what's interesting about a prism is that its ability to transform white light into rainbows is not a function of how big the prism is, right? It's a function of the design choices that you make at the heart of the prism, right? It's a function of what the kind of structure is of the crystal that you create inside the prism itself. And that's what we found really with these movements, is that the movements that were the most effective at translating the engagement of their people into the power they want was really a function of the kind of design choices that they made. That essentially, you know, the way in which we construct ourselves determines or at least it partially determines the extent to which we're able to exercise power in the world. You know, the resources themselves are not power, right? So often when we think about movements that are powerful, people will say like, oh, you should look at X and X movement. They raised this many dollars, right? Or, oh, you should look at this movement because they got millions of people to sign on to their event or something like that. And we assume that just because a movement is able to garner a lot of resources, whether it be people or money or public opinion or something like that, that they're able to translate that into power. And there's so much research shows that we're living in this moment all over the world where the relationship between participation and power is broken, right? And so we know that we need organizations or movements or vehicles or unions that can translate people's participation into political power, but what kind, right? What are the characteristics of the vehicles that we need to create? And so in this study, a lot of what we did is set out to learn from the outliers. Like we wanted to say, okay, we know in general, there's this broken link between participation and power, but what if we were to look at the outliers, the places where ordinary people and movements were actually able to translate power, participation into power? What do they look like? Are there any commonalities across them? But what we found was that there were a set of commonalities, that it wasn't just a bunch of idiosyncratic kind of lucky people that got together, but that the organizations that were most effective at translating power, it's not just that they were really effective at getting people involved, although that, of course, is a challenge for any kind of people-powered organization, but they also were imagining and architecting a different way in which we can understand politics. For example, you know, what we're doing in this table is trying to compare what are the kind of dominant models of collective action that exist both in academic literature, but also in what we see in the kind of organizations that we build out in the world. And on the right-hand side is what is the logic of these prisms that we were observing. And the dominant kind of expectation is that a lot of organizations that are trying to build people power sort of have this baseline expectation of responsiveness, right? That if only I can get enough people to pour out into the streets, then political officials will have to listen, right? And in contrast, the organizations that we studied had no expectation of responsiveness from political elites. And instead, they built their entire strategy on this idea that at some point we're going to get challenged. And those challenges are going to come from unpredictable places. So from the very beginning, they're starting from a different starting point, right? And that led to a different kind of strategic logic that we sort of play out in the book. So for people that had, for organizations that had this kind of baseline expectation of responsiveness, then there's sort of this idea that if they could accrue enough resources, whether it's money, public opinion, people at a protest event, different kind of things, that essentially that would get them either media attention or get them the kind of proximity to power, right? It would get them access to the decision makers that they needed. The problem was often that they often mistook access to power for power itself, or proximity to power for power itself. And when they were so focused on maintaining access or proximity to power, what it meant was that they were not as nimble in negotiating or pushing elite decision makers when they actually needed to. And so the organizations that were acting more like prisms that we study, what they were able to do is they developed an independent source of power that didn't depend on access to elites. So if they got a seat at the decision-making table, they didn't earn that seat by having to have elite people kind of give them access to it, but instead they earned it because of the quality and the characteristics of the constituency that they are able to build. And so learning that kind of like key difference between access to power and power itself kind of led to a whole set of practices that we begin to elucidate, where the question essentially is, well, how do you build the kind of constituency that gets you the kind of access to power that you need without depending on elite patronage? Another way to kind of think about the logic is that the key thing that these organizations were trying to maximize is, instead of maximizing resources, meaning like the kinds of things that they had, instead they were thinking about it more in terms of how do we maximize strategic choice, right? So the idea is that if you know that at some point you're going to face challenge to your power, then the question is, how do you respond in that moment that you're challenged? And what these organizations are constantly thinking about is that in that moment when we get challenged, how can we make sure that we have as many tools in our toolbox, as many choices as possible to be able to respond? So that's the first point. Second point is, okay, if you want to have as many choices as possible in that strategic choice set when you get challenged, then the question is, well, what do you need? Well, it turns out what you need is you need resources that have three characteristics. They should be independent, committed, and flexible, right? And so what do we mean by that? Independent means the resources are your own to control as opposed to depending on access to someone else, right? So if I need to raise $1 million in order to be able to reach and call through my entire base, that's not an independent resource, right? Because I can't access my base without getting someone to give me $1 million. Right? Committed is pretty clear, right? You want people that are committed to sticking with you. And flexible means so often the organizations that we build have commitments to like a narrow policy agenda or a narrow issue agenda, but they don't have the flexibility to stay with a movement over time as that movement is moving through the ups and downs of any political campaign. And so the question is, how do you build a constituency base that is independent, committed, and flexible, right? Those are the kind of goals that you had in whatever resource that you wanted to build. And then the third kind of thing that we found was that certain kind of organizations were able to build constituencies with those three characteristics if they made a certain set of design choices. The things that we found that were most consistent had to do with the relationship of accountability between leaders and members, the extent to which there was a constantly evolving latticework of relationships that enmeshed people in relationship with each other, the extent to which people are engaged in relationships where they're bridging across difference, and the extent to which leadership is distributed throughout the organization. The first thing is this idea of like, how do we think about what it means to maximize strategic choice? So this is an example from a campaign that we studied in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is a medium-sized Midwestern city. Ohio is a battleground state traditionally in the United States. And this is an organization that was trying to fight for universal preschool for the poorest kids in Cincinnati. And the way race relations in Cincinnati work is basically a black-white racial divide. So essentially what they're doing is they're trying to advocate for universal preschool, publicly funded universal preschool for poor black children in Cincinnati. And we did this sort of survey with a lot of the political elites in Cincinnati, where we interviewed like elected officials, philanthropists, business leaders, all sorts of people in the city, and said, in 2013, when you thought about education issues in your city, who do you think about? Who are you working with, right? Who are the people that you're exchanging information with? Who are the people you're strategizing with? Who are you actually aligning your resources with? And then with whom are you negotiating conflict? And what we found was that the organization that we were studying, they were basically nowhere on the map. Like they were basically on the very edge of the map in 2013, right? No one was really working with them or reaching out to them at all in that time. But then between 2013 and 2016, they ran this campaign where they were able to kind of organize in the Black community that was going to be most effective and essentially build a big constituency base around universal preschool so that by 2016, when the issue was actually up for a vote, they were at the very center of all these networks, at the center of the information network, of the strategy network, of the resource network. And interestingly, they are also at the center of the conflict network, which meant that they weren't in that network in a way that just gave them access to power, but they were the ones that were holding a lot of tension in the network. They were negotiating a lot of conflict with a lot of the other kind of elite players in Cincinnati. And it was by being able to sort of like move into that power network that they were able to expand the kind of set of strategic choices that they had. And so what does that mean? And so they did that because they had this kind of independent, committed, and flexible base. And so this is just an example of a typical campaign timeline that many of you have probably seen where, you know, the campaign starts down here and then over time is trying to build more and more people. But what was really interesting about this organization in Cincinnati and all the organizations that we studied is that at every moment when they're thinking about key campaign events, so these could be big rallies, it could be big meetings, it could be protest events, it could be an election, you know, all the different kind of key moments that mark a campaign, they were constantly thinking about how do we build that event in a way that constantly builds our infrastructure within the constituency base. Right. And so they're essentially building out this like networked infrastructure. You know, we call it kind of like a lattice work of relationships within the constituency base. And that lattice work is essentially what gave them the independence, commitment, and flexibility that they needed. So that, you know, back when they're in the time between 2013 and 2016, there were certain key moments in the campaign where their power got challenged by, you know, business leaders in Cincinnati, by elected officials, by, you know, various players who are trying to block their agenda. And they were able in that moment to respond with the kind of voice of all these constituencies that they had built, because, and that's what enabled them to kind of be at the center of this negotiating conflict map. And so you have that. And then we also have just sort of like one more example here that isn't from Ohio. It's from a campaign in Minnesota, where what we want to show is that, you know, for a lot of these organizations, it's not like building out this infrastructure took a tremendous amount of time. So this is just a graph over 3 months where you had one paid staff organizer right there in the middle. The only person on this entire graph who's paid is that one dot in the middle. And she had seven volunteer leaders around her that she organized, and that was her leadership team. And then each of those seven volunteer leaders were responsible for, over the course of a month, recruiting 10 to 12 what they called democracy builders. And each of those democracy builders were volunteers, right, that those leaders worked with to kind of train them on how to be a democracy builder. And then a lot of our elections happened in November. Over the course of the next month, each of those democracy builders were responsible for reaching out to a whole network of voters in the community. And so what we had was this one staff person who was essentially responsible for 28,000 contacts in her community by building out this kind of infrastructure of leadership that was then able to kind of build the sort of independent, committed, and flexible base that you need at scale. So that's just sort of like another example of that. And the last kind of example that I'll sort of highlight is this idea becomes, okay, so let's say, you know, you kind of buy this idea that like movements work in uncertain environments. And because they work in uncertain environments, they have to maximize strategic choice. And in order to maximize strategic choice, they have to invest in their resources, their people, right, that are independent, committed, and flexible. Then the question is, if I'm a leader right now and I'm trying to think about how can I build up my constituency base to be independent, committed, and flexible, what are the choices that I need to make right now? And the kind of point that I want to make is that there are design choices about that heart, the heart of that prison, that enable that kind of constituency. So what are a couple examples? So one analogy, and this is one that I think is probably not going to translate well to this setting, is so the analogy I want to say is like build an aspen tree as opposed to an oak tree. And I think those are very American trees. And so I don't know if it's going to translate well, but here's what I mean. So aspens are skinny little trees, right? They're often the analogy that people use in the US is that they're quaking aspens, right? So they kind of like, they bend and weave in the wind. And an oak tree is like a giant old oak tree, you know, that tends to have like a really thick base, it's hundreds of years old, it's very sturdy and really stable. And what's really interesting is that one thing that really differentiates aspen trees from oak trees is that aspen trees, what we see above ground is just lots of separate trees. But if you looked beneath the aspen tree, what it turns out is that you can have an entire grove of aspens that shares one root system, right? So it's one set of roots that feeds, you know, 50 aspen trees in a grove or something like that. Whereas an oak tree has one set of roots that feeds one tree, okay? And in movements, what we found is that the kind of design choices, one of the design choices that you wanted essentially was to build a metaphorical aspen as opposed to a metaphorical oak, right? And the reason for that is that having a movement that had this kind of now I'm like really mixing metaphors, but have like a cellular structure or this kind of, you know, structure where you had one set of roots, like one core organizational culture, right? That then sprouted lots of different groups within it, subgroups within it, right? Enabled that movement or that organization to have the kind of flexibility that it needed to sort of bend in moments of conflict instead of breaking. Right. So often when movements or organizations or unions or whatever get challenged from the outside, whether it's like a big economic challenge or it could be a political challenge or it could be an internal challenge arising from inside, then organizations often fall apart because they don't have the flexibility to sort of like bend in response to that. And a lot of what we found was that structure, the way in which the organization is structured, enables people to exercise voice in moments of conflict that gave the movement the kind of flexibility that it needed in moments of tension, right? So that would be one example of a design choice. Another example is that there is this idea in the management literature that talks about the difference between operational and strategic capabilities. So an operational capability is like a set of capabilities that all organizations need in order to operate, right? So everyone needs an HR system. Everyone needs a donor management database. Everyone needs a volunteer management system. Everyone needs some kind of communication system. Those are all operational capabilities. Every organization needs that. But what really differentiates organizations that tend to be very powerful over time from those that don't are the second order capabilities. And the second order capabilities are strategic, right? And so the kind of tagline is, if the first order capability is about doing things right, the second order capability is about doing things right at the right time, right? So it means that the second order capability requires judgment. And basically what we find is that, you know, there are three processes that underlie an organization's ability to have the kind of second order capabilities that it needs. And those processes are called sensing, seizing, and transforming. So sensing is basically this idea that the world is changing around me all the time. I have to be able to sense the changes that are coming my way, right? Seizing is the idea that the world is changing around me all the time. How do I know which of the changes I have to be able to act on and which ones I don't? That's seizing, right? So it's essentially, it's a question of governance, meaning how do I differentiate the signal from the noise, right? The world is rapidly changing. How do I know when I need to adapt and change in response to it? And how do I know when I can stay the course on my existing strategy? So that's a question of governance, is seizing. And the third process is transforming. Once I figured out there's a change out there in the world that I need to change to, that I need to adapt to, is my movement, my union, my organization adaptable enough to be able to transform itself to meet the new moment? And so there are a set of capabilities then that underlie an organization's ability to engage in these processes of sensing, seizing, and transforming. And so those are things like structure, which we talked about, the Aspens versus the Oaks, governance, right? What are the processes of decision-making and deliberation within the organization? What is the extent to which that is distributed among a set of people versus centralized within central authority? Co-specialization is the idea of what is the extent to which people within the organization work interdependently, right? Because if they work interdependently, they're better able to transform themselves in moments that are needed versus when they don't work interdependently, then when you ask people to transform themselves, all of a sudden they don't have the kind of informal knowledge or the relationships that it takes to remake the way in which they do their work. Accountability is, you know, what is the extent to which leaders are accountable to a base of people and have clear lines of those accountability so that when they're engaging in sensing and seizing, they're actually mechanisms to make sure that they're sensing the changes in their people that they need, and they're able to make decisions about how to act in ways that are responsive to the needs of the members themselves. And then commitment is, what is the extent to which you have that kind of commitment throughout the organization to be able to adapt and have people with you in all of these moments. And so often, you know, we live in a culture right now that's a culture of exit, meaning whenever people don't like what an organization is doing, they tend to just leave. And right now, the organizations that we found that were most effective were really good at building not a culture of exit, but a culture of voice, right? Of having people, when people disagree with you, instead of having the impulse to leave, the impulse was to try to figure out, how can I try to voice my concerns so that I can have my voice heard, right? And that only worked in organizations that actually had mechanisms of voice available to them.